As if the relentless bombing and the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza were not enough. The one sanctuary where Palestinians should have felt safe became a death trap. The protection of hospitals during warfare is paramount and must be respected by all sides at all times. These were the words of UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, describing the hospitals in Gaza that should be protected under international law. The Geneva Convention states that medical units shall not be the object of attack. They shall be respected and protected at all times and shall not be used for military purposes. The wounded and sick shall be collected and cared for. Since the beginning of Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza, which has claimed the lives of over 50,000 Palestinians and wounded 113,000 others, Israel has repeatedly targeted hospitals, committing mass atrocities against those seeking refuge in medical facilities, facilities that are protected under international law. These attacks intensified with the onset of ground operations, almost destroying every major medical center in Gaza, and leading to the killing, persecution, and kidnapping of the people and the medical personnel. A ceasefire agreement was reached on January 19, 2025, with the expectation that humanitarian aid and supplies would flood Gaza, improving the health system and allowing for the urgent evacuation of patients. However, Israel failed to meet its obligation and by March 1st declared the complete suspension of humanitarian supplies to Gaza, including fuel to operate remaining hospitals. On March 13th, the 53rd day of the ceasefire, a United Nations Independent International Commission of Inquiry published a report listing certain Israeli violations against Gaza's medical facilities as genocidal acts. How did Israel respond? On March 18th, Israel resumed its large-scale attacks across Gaza, collapsing the ceasefire and killing over 850 Palestinians. The following Sunday, on March 23rd, at least 15 civil and medical crew members went missing in Rafah following their operations there to rescue the Palestinians who were targeted and trapped by the Israeli occupation forces on the ground. Later that day at 9 p.m., Israeli bombed the male surgical department inside Nasser Medical Complex in central Khan Yunis, killing two Palestinians, including a child, and injuring eight others and rendering the entire department out of service. I'm Ahmed al-Najjar, and today for more on this to discuss the deteriorating health system under Israel's ongoing aggression, I am joined by Dr. Farouz Sidwa, an American trauma and general surgeon based in California and is now volunteering here in Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, southern Gaza Strip. Dr. Farouz, thank you so much for joining us, for finding time amid all that you are experiencing these days.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you. So, from California to the Gaza Strip, during a very critical and challenging time and reality here in Gaza. If you could share with us your journey, what brings you here to the Gaza Strip? And we understand that you've been here in certain key periods all over the course of this genocide. You've been here last year, and you came back during the ceasefire, and now witnessing the resumption of that genocide. How would you describe the health system situation in Gaza during these three periods?
Yeah, the first time I was here was 1 year ago, March 25th to April 8th, and I was on the eastern side of Khan Yunis at European Hospital, Gaza. And that back then, the hospital basically wasn't functioning. It was because the refugees were inside the hospital, and basically the hospital was a shelter more so than a hospital. We lacked supplies. We lacked almost everything that we needed. But the biggest problem was just there was no way for a hospital to function like this. And the same was happening at Nasser. The same was happening. Literally every hospital was the same way because people had nowhere to go, nowhere that they thought was safe. So now that I'm back, Nasser was raided and put out of service by the Israelis in March of last year. So about a year ago. And in, I think, May it reopened, maybe. And the administration decided that they won't allow refugees into the hospital again. So this has allowed the hospital to function properly, but that is the only improvement that I have seen. Otherwise, everything is worse, even before the ceasefire, honestly. during or even before the ceasefire was destroyed. When I came back, it was March 6th. That was the first day I worked here. And the first case that I saw was a 24-year-old man, and he was crawling through the ruins of his apartment trying to find the body of his father, who had been killed many months ago. And the building collapsed on him, and it tore his left kidney off of his aorta. So he almost bled to death. It also broke his spine. He may never use one of his legs again. Then the next case I saw was a young man shot in the left chest in Rafah from the large sniper tower that the Israelis had built there. And he came in, we put a chest tube in him, we operated on him, thankfully he did okay. But all of this just shows you that the number one, the violence didn't stop. Even though there weren't major explosions happening in Khan Yunis, the explosions that happened months ago were still killing people. When their houses would collapse on them, when children would fall out of the window or off the third floor because the buildings were not stable, this is a major problem. This was a major problem. And then the shootings from the Israelis didn't stop. It was much less, of course, but it didn't stop. And the fact that the territory, Gaza, still has no normal connection to the outside world, even during the ceasefire, no normal connection to the outside world. I think you mentioned the Israelis never allowed the tents in that they were supposed to allow during the ceasefire. They never allowed the mobile homes that they were supposed to allow during the ceasefire. They never allowed the proper number of aid trucks in. They prioritized the wrong type of aid, the wrong types of food, things like snacks instead of things like meat for a population that's been malnourished for a year, and especially milk for children, things like this. And then they didn't allow for the evacuation of medical of wounded people like they said they would, and they tried to restrict, and in fact did restrict, the entrance of foreign medical personnel like myself coming from the United States, from Europe, from Australia, Jordan, wherever. So overall, the situation actually just continued to get worse. It's true that from, you know, January 19th to March 18th, when there was a bit of a ceasefire, some more food got in, and there was some more water availability, some fuel came in. But on, March 2nd, I think, the Israelis closed the border again. And since then, there has been no way for people to afford protein to eat. They can only afford the bread and rice that they get from the World Central Kitchen, the World Food Program. There has been no resupply of hospitals. The Nasser still has what we need to do life-saving operations to stop people from bleeding to death. But they don't. We don't have the equipment needed to do reconstructive work. So, for example, a lot of people, including children, have had blast injuries to their arms, and they didn't die. So, alhamdulillah, thankfully, great. That's great. But they have nerve injuries. So their hands are clawing. They're not able to use their hand properly. This is going to be a disabling injury forever.
The question, the lack of supplies to Gaza, the lack of all humanitarian supplies for the people here, since the start of that genocide, all the needs of the people have been weaponized against them. After the start of the ceasefire, the flow of aid, the improvement for the life here should have been achieved. Yet somehow it got worse. By March the 2nd, the suspension of all humanitarian supplies to Gaza, food, the cutting of power to one of the last desalination plants here in southern Gaza. And of course, how this affects the medical facilities here with the patients inside them. Now, many of the people here, the injured, the wounded, are fortunate to have such expert medical professionals like yourself. But even with that, the lack of supplies is pretty much challenging. How do you manage these challenges?
Yeah, so it's a few things. Number one, for my own work as a surgeon, we don't have all of the supplies that we would normally have, even in a poor country's hospital. We don't have wound vac supplies anymore. The certain types of sutures are harder to find. Right now, at Nasser, we do have the equipment that we need to do life-saving care, but not reconstructive care, so that people can improve their lives also. At other hospitals in Gaza, and especially in the north, the supplies are gone. There's very little that's available. They're making do with the wrong things, but they have no choice. Anesthetics are gone. Antibiotics are not available. Thankfully, here the situation is better, but it will not last forever because, like you said, the border is closed. So the hospital cannot purchase new material. It can't receive new material. And it's not just humanitarian aid that's not being allowed in. Nothing is being allowed into Gaza, not normal commerce. You can't purchase something and have it shipped here because the Israelis simply won't allow it. It doesn't matter if you paid for it. It doesn't matter if it's donated. It's nothing. But beyond just the surgical supplies in the hospital, the fact that people don't have clean water means they're coming in sick even before they get injured. The fact that they don't have protein to eat means that their body will not heal properly and they will not fight infections properly, no matter what we do. And the fact that they have no homes. I mean, in the background here, you can see every building is seriously damaged. They have no homes, no way of protecting themselves from the weather. So all of this takes a toll on the human body, slowly, slowly, slowly. And all of it is resulting in the health of people being much, much lower than it should be.
And when it comes to this resumption of the large-scale attacks across the Gaza Strip since March 18th, how do you describe the situation in the hospital, the number of the patients, the wounded received here? How do you keep up with treating such large numbers?
Yeah, so actually the Palestinians have learned to do what we call mass casualty very well, just from a lot of experience, unfortunately. Not just in this war, but in the previous ones as well, during the Great March of Return, all these things. They have an efficient system in place, but again, without supplies, without the needed number of surgeons, without the needed number of operating rooms, without beds. I mean, this whole ward has been destroyed, and the 26 beds that were here, we can't use anymore, because how can you house someone in this place? So it's making it very challenging to keep up with the injured. Most of them, even though we can fix their surgical problem, they're still very sick and they need an intensive care unit, the ICU. But we don't have the supplies that are needed or the personnel or the infection control measures. All of this is not available. And so many patients that we save in the operating room die in the ICU later, mostly of infections. Simply because we just don't have the supplies, the resources to care for them. We can't test them properly to see what infection they actually have. Here at Nasser Hospital, we don't have a neurosurgeon. The only neurosurgeons are at European hospitals. So if somebody has bleeding in their abdomen, but they also have a bad brain injury, this is the biggest hospital in Gaza right now because Shifa is mostly non-functioning. So in the biggest hospital in any place, you would have a general trauma surgeon and a neurosurgeon. They could work on the patient at the same time. But right now, we have to stop the bleeding in the abdomen, hope that the brain injury doesn't kill them for 2 days, and then we can send them to European Hospital for brain surgery. But at that point, they don't even need it anymore. They lived, you know. So these are very, very challenging things. And again, with a population that is so sick to start with, you know, the children have not had clean water for almost 2 years. They've not gone to school for almost 2 years. They haven't eaten normally for almost 2 years. They've been displaced over and over and over again. Their levels of stress are through the roof. So it's a very, very challenging thing to take care of.
So speaking of this ward we are sitting right now, the male surgical department inside the Nasser Medical Complex, a ward filled with wounded people who survived the attacks of the Israelis and finally grateful to receive some sort of treatment that hopefully would help them survive the Israeli missiles, follow them where they are seeking treatment. A man and a boy, how do you respond to this?
Well, they're criminal. And in the case of the attack on this ward, actually, I was almost killed here. The emergency medical teams live on the fourth floor of the hospital, and this is the second floor. And I was coming down to change a patient of mine, his dressings. This is a 16-year-old boy named Ibrahim Barhum. I was on my way to change his dressings and just 10 minutes before the bombing. I have to walk past the intensive care unit to come down here. And one of the doctors there said, "Oh, Feroz, can you help us with this other patient because they're bleeding and we don't know what to do?" So I said, "Oh, yeah, sure." So I went in there, assessed that patient. That took about 10 or 15 minutes. And then I said, "Look, we need to take this guy to the operating room." So I told the ICU, "You tell the operating room so that they can do that. And then I'm going to come change Ibrahim's dressing, and then I'll come back and we'll do the operation." But when I walked out of the ICU, that's when the bomb went off. And I assume Ibrahim was right here. I would have been standing right here working, just changing his abdomen, talking to his family, because he was going to go home the next day. He was well. So, you know, that hit me very personally, obviously. Number one, because my patient was killed. I've never had a patient killed in their hospital bed before. But number two, I've also never been that close to being killed by a military strike. So, but no, it's criminal. It's criminal in two different ways. Number one, hospitals are civilian objects in international law. And medical personnel, meaning me as a doctor or somebody as a nurse, whatever, are also protected people. And it's not just the doctors and nurses, it's actually also the administrators that work in a hospital. Basically, everyone who provides care to the wounded is protected. And that's not just part of the Fourth Geneva Convention from the 1940s, I suppose. It's actually part of the very first Geneva Convention of 1864. So we're talking about, you know, during the time of the American Civil War, things that people said should be illegal in warfare. That's what the U.S. and Israel are doing now. It's really crazy. But number two, so that's one thing. Patients medical personnel in hospitals are protected. But like you mentioned, hospitals are not to be militarized. And the Israelis have been claiming that Ismail Barhum, simply because he is in Hamas, his presence here is militarization of the hospital. They also said he's planning terrorist attacks here, but that's ridiculous. The hospital is a free area. Everybody could walk around and do whatever they wanted. Nobody saw any such thing. I looked at his picture, actually, because I'd never met him. So I looked at his picture online today. I never saw that man doing anything, walking over. They said he had been here for weeks. It's ridiculous. But so the actual facts of the matter are that he was wounded in a bombing on either the 18th or the 19th, and then he came here to seek treatment because he was probably trying to recover without being in public, but then he couldn't, so he came here to seek treatment. And not only are hospitals and medical professionals protected, but wounded combatants, leaving aside that he's not a combatant, he's just a civilian, but wounded combatants are also protected under international law. When a person is wounded in battle, and then they are being cared for by a medical professional, the doctor, but also the patient are protected. So it's a double crime. It's a crime to attack the hospital at all, but it's also even a crime to kill Ismail Barhum. Because I understand he's in Hamas, he does the finances or something, but that doesn't mean you can just kill him. And we can see it very easily if we just look at Israel instead. You know, Benjamin Netanyahu had his prostate removed, so it's a surgery. In late December, I think maybe December 27th or something like that. And the next day, I'm sure from his hospital, because he was in the hospital for 4 days, I'm sure from his hospital room, he was running the Israeli war effort. So he militarized a hospital, for sure. Does anyone think that Hamas can go into that hospital and shoot him in the head? No one thinks this. It's crazy. So why is the opposite allowed? Or why is it allowed if the shoe is on the other foot?
Speaking of Benjamin Netanyahu and the militarization of hospitals, I was actually speaking to the director of field hospitals here in Gaza about the targeting of this department, and he said that nothing justifies the targeting of medical facilities. Even if Benjamin Netanyahu himself was being treated inside this hospital, nothing justifies it. Nothing allows anyone to target hospitals.
And just think about it this way. Suppose an Israeli soldier was wounded and a Palestinian brought him here to the hospital and I did surgery on him. Can Hamas bomb this hospital to kill the Israeli soldier in his bed? It's insane. Nobody would accept this.
And the Israelis just keep using this pretext of that hospitals are being used for military purposes by military groups, terrorist groups, and the Gaza Strip. But what is happening is that the Israelis themselves are coming in and turning these hospitals into military barracks. So what kind of paradoxical concept is that?
Well, it's a good question. And this is where you see that some people are considered human beings in the Western media and some people are not. Not just the Western media, the Western culture in general. The Israelis occupied Turkish Friendship Hospital, which is north of here, just outside of the Netzarim corridor. They occupied it, I think, in July and destroyed almost the entire hospital, just bit by bit, not blowing it up, just smashing this, smashing that, breaking this, breaking that. And a lot of them, the soldiers were putting videos online of them doing this. Oh, look, I'm going to smash this ultrasound machine. I'm going to smash this monitor just for fun because they were bored inside the hospital. So they turned it into a military barracks, right? Well, okay, that's militarization of the hospital. They kicked all the patients out, of course, and there was, you know. So that's militarization of the hospital. So if Hamas were to attack Israeli soldiers in that hospital at that time, especially when there's no patients and the hospital isn't functioning, nobody would claim that this is a crime. But now, just a few days ago, maybe on the 17th, I think, maybe on the 22nd, I can't remember exactly, the Israelis went back to Turkish Friendship Hospital, laid out charges, put up a video camera outside the hospital, and just blew it up on camera. How could it possibly be justified? But this is the thing. It just doesn't matter in the Western discourse, in the United States, in Europe. It doesn't really matter. You're not allowed to just say the simple and obvious truth. The Israelis are deliberately destroying a healthcare system with the backing of the United States and Europe. You're not allowed to just say simple things that are obvious to anybody with half a brain can figure it out. Now, you ask a 10-year-old kid to look at the evidence, they'll tell you exactly what's going on. But you're not allowed to say it. And this is what perpetuates the idea. The only way that this can come about is because Palestinians, Arabs in general, but especially Palestinians, are just not seen as human beings.
So coming to my final question, and forgive me for taking it to a personal level. On October the 2nd, 2024, you, among 99 other medical professionals who served here in Gaza during this genocide, wrote a letter to the Biden administration at the time, urging them to stop arming Israel. In it, you stated your testimonies, what you've witnessed as medical professionals, your expertise poured in that letter, and the atrocities you've witnessed. You said in it, and I quote, "I have never seen such injuries on such massive scale. With so few sources, our bombs are cutting down women and children by thousands. Their mutilated bodies are a monument of cruelty." The Biden administration is gone. Trump's administration now is in charge. Trump presented himself as the peacemaker, the anti-war president, and all of a sudden, this changed, and is now basically telling Israel to finish the job. How do you, not only as a medical professional, but as an American citizen, what do you think would convince this administration to stop arm Israel?
I don't know what would convince them, but I am a doctor, so I come to places like Gaza. I've also worked in Ukraine. I've worked in plenty of other places, too. And one of the advantages of coming to a place like this is you see that people are just human beings everywhere. Everyone wants to take care of their family. Everyone wants to have enough food to eat. Everyone wants to enjoy their culture. Nothing unusual. And the same is true here. But when I go back to the United States, I can tell people about the professional work I did, which I do. But I also want people to understand that we are committing crimes in Gaza. People use the word complicit. They say America is complicit in Israel's crimes, but this isn't correct. That implies that Israel is committing the crimes and we're just in the background or something. The U.S. and Israel are committing crimes in Gaza together. It's American airplanes, it's American helicopters, it's American bombs, even the tanks, these vaunted Merkava tanks. They're basically made in the United States. So I don't accept that my government has to be involved in committing crimes against people who have done us no wrong. So what would convince the Trump administration? I don't know. But I hope something will, and I'll keep trying to find it until I can.
Dr. Farouz Sidwa, thank you for your time. Thank you for joining us and for your efforts and everything you've done here in Gaza. Thank you so much for joining us in this special program. Hope you stay safe, and goodbye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A failure to act on its legal obligations deepens the UK government's complicity in the Zionist regime's violent oppression of the Palestinian people. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, for decades, successive UK governments have held the position that Israel's settlements on occupied Palestinian land are illegal under international law. Despite having this clear legal position, the perfidy and hypocrisy of the UK government is without end. The government has both a moral and a legal duty under international law to prohibit all UK investment and trade with a settlement enterprise of any regime that has transferred its own civilian population into the occupied territories, an activity constituting a grievous breach of the preemptory norms of international law. Since 1967, the Zionist regime has seized thousands of dönems of Palestinian land to establish its illegal settlements, part of a long-held strategy to ethnically cleanse Palestinians and hem them into tiny Bantustans. Israel's goal is to annex the West Bank with as few Palestinians on the land as possible. This long-held policy of maximum Jew minimum Palestinians is being implemented in real time, with 40,000 Palestinians recently having been forcibly displaced from Jenin and last year's erasure of at least 50 entire communities. In establishing illegal settlements, the Israeli regime has created facts on the ground to ensure that a Palestinian state is rendered impossible. Yet despite the UK government acknowledging that these activities threaten peace and the physical viability of a two-state solution, the British toothless government has failed to impose meaningful sanctions while continuing to allow the import and sale of illegal settlement goods. This runs counter to the nation's duty under international law. It is a deliberate choice that has rendered the UK government complicit in Israel's criminality and violent systematic oppression of the Palestinian people. The government has avoided publishing a formal response to the July 2024 findings of the International Court of Justice, which deemed Israel's decades-long occupation to be unlawful and highlighted the global community's responsibility to act accordingly. The UK has a duty to not render aid or assistance to Israel's illegal settlement enterprise and to bring to an end serious breaches of preemptory norms of international law. In refusing to prohibit such activities, the UK regime stands in violation of its obligation to not recognize as legal the situation arising from Israel's unlawful presence in the occupied Palestinian territories. All of this is clearly a violation of the obligations and duties of the 30 states, which could result in the UK being held legally culpable in the Zionist regime's violations. In In recent years, the UK government has been given multiple opportunities to impose a ban on the importation of goods from illegal Israeli settlements. But despite rhetorical condemnation, the only practical measures taken have been to exclude these goods from tariff and trade preferences, while advising UK businesses to bear in mind that Israel settlements are illegal under international law. Nothing of substance has been done to uphold the UK's obligations to isolate Israel's illegal settlement enterprise and bring an end to these serious breaches of international law, which, at the bare minimum, should entail a ban on purchases or investments in that enterprise. By allowing the continuation of economic activities, including charitable work with the Zionist regime's illegal settlement enterprise, through a refusal to implement a strict ban, the UK regime is effectively disregarding the ICJ's advice that third states must take steps to prevent trade or investment relations that assist in the maintenance of the illegal situation created by the Zionist regime in the occupied Palestinian territory. Rather outrageously, in a recent session of the Parliamentary Foreign Affairs Committee, Middle East Minister Hamish Falconer acknowledged that products from Israel's illegal settlements are sold in the UK and that it's up to individual businesses to decide whether to stock them. Turning this into an optional choice provides a convenient loophole that shifts the burden of action away from the government and onto individual business and trading entities themselves. This effectively greenlights such economic ties. Without further progress on the matter, including an immediate shift in policy to ban all economic activity involving illegal settlements, the British are complicit as a country in the violent oppression of Palestinians and the occupation of Palestinian land and failing to live up to their obligated duties under international law. The UK should immediately enact a full trade ban and prohibit any economic activities with the Zionist regime's illegal settlements. Should the government continue to evade its duties, then the dozens of MPs who last month issued a letter demanding such a ban must act to bring a private member's bill to this effect, similar to the legislation Ireland is considering. Their devolved assemblies and parliaments in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland should also implement their own bans within their jurisdictions, and local authorities should take steps to implement ethical investment policies to ensure their assets and pension funds are not tied to any illegal settlement enterprises too. Without such a move, the government cannot continue claiming to oppose settlements. The UK government must be consistent in its application and upholding of international law, or else face severe legal consequences for continued their inaction. We may also soon see cases arise where Palestinians living in the UK rightfully take up legal action against businesses and companies that ignore the UK government's advice by continuing their economic activities with illegal settlements, a matter that should be seen as a clear warning to all.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, trust in God. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab, on RB English Radio. So obviously the title for today is Trust in God, and this is a really general title. I'm going to sort of narrow it down a little bit just with a particular example from the life of one of our most famous martyrs who was martyred recently. So I'm referring to His Eminence the Sayyid. And so, for example, people would ask him about a particular statement he would make because he would always promise victory. And then when asked, for example, if one of his family members would ask him, well, why do you always make this statement? And then obviously the Sayyid would respond and just say, well, you know, he was obviously referring to the Quran here. And then he would sort of ask the another question, say, well, you know, don't you read the Quran? You know, this is in the Quran. And so obviously he would explain, and this is an explanation for all of us, of course. So obviously we need to have this trust. Whatever it is that is promised to us by Allah, we trust this. And obviously the Sayyid himself would explain this. He would say that obviously as this is in the Quran, and God sort of defends those who believe, and God says that if we support God, God will support us. And this applies across all contexts. This does not just apply in specific scenarios, obviously referring to in the Sayyid speech. This applies across our lives. So when we read, when the Quran tells us that, yes, Allah will support us, if we support Allah, if we are trying to achieve proximity to Allah, then Allah will also support us. And of course, this is also the idea. We must ask everything of Allah. And in a sense, and the promise also is if we sort out, if we make sure our relationship with Allah is correct, Allah will sort of resolve all these sort of, I call them knots and issues in our life, in this world. Welcome back. This is A to Z on RB English Radio, and so obviously I'm talking about trust in God, and I was referring to the example of His Eminence the Sayyid and a particular statement he would make, and he would obviously, as his answer, refer back to the Quran and say that obviously Allah promises to the believers, those people who support Him, that He will support them. And obviously, this touches on another very important concept, and the Sayyid would also highlight this particular concept. He would say, this is certain. And obviously, certain is something very particular. And obviously, Allah does not make jokes. So the promises that Allah makes in the Quran, these are things we have certainty in. So whatever it is that Allah has said we will do for us. So this, in a sense, this should help us a little bit. I know that I today was thinking about certainty on my way back from uni, for example. And for example, in my situation, there was a particular thing that had not happened. And I was just wondering and thinking to myself, well, obviously, if I had this sort of certainty that obviously the best believers, our martyrs, achieve, then these sorts of doubts and worries would not even enter my mind, would not enter our mind. You know, whatever it is, if whether you're waiting for something, waiting for a response for something, there's an issue in your life that needs to be resolved. Maybe you have an issue, a quarrel with someone in the family, you don't know what to do. But obviously, trust in God is something that again, to some extent, gives us the idea that, no, this is, every single thing can be resolved. Some of the things, obviously, we especially ask for help from Allah. There's some little things that, obviously, we need to do. We need to do the striving. But really what I'm saying is that, yeah, certainty. Try and make, think about how you can get to that high level where you achieve certainty in the promise that Allah has given us. So inshallah, that's just a few extra reminders for you, and I look forward to welcoming you back to another episode of A to Z here on RB English Radio, and farewell for today. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
In the limelight. The Trump administration on Friday, 28th of March, asked the U.S. Supreme Court to intervene to allow the government to continue to deport immigrants using the obscure Alien Enemies Act. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The United States has ordered consular officers to significantly expand their screening processes for student visa applicants, including through comprehensive social media investigations to exclude people they deem to support terrorism. Coming after several high-profile visa revocations and targeted arrests over pro-Palestinian campus activism, a State Department cable from 25th of March obtained by The Guardian describes a new standard for visa denials based on a broad definition of what constitutes support for terrorist activity. The directive states that evidence that an applicant advocates for terrorist activity or otherwise demonstrates a degree of public approval or public advocacy for terrorist activity or a terrorist organization can be grounds for visa rejection. It specifically targets new and renewing F, M, and J student visa applications, providing explicit instructions for consular officers to conduct mandatory social media reviews, digging into applicants' lives online. Officers are directed to examine the social media of all students applying to a visa for evidence of activities the administration defines as a threat to national security or terrorism. The directive mandates that fraud prevention units which received flagged applications take screenshots of potentially derogatory social media content, creating a permanent digital record that can be used to deny entry into the United States. Those officers are instructed to preserve screenshots to the extent it is relevant to a visa ineligibility and upload them to the applicant's case record, even if the posts are later altered or deleted. The memo sent by the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, says evidence that an applicant advocates for terrorist activity or otherwise demonstrates a degree of public approval or public advocacy for terrorist activity or a terrorist organization may be indicative of ineligibility. The statement adds, this may be evident in conduct that bears a hostile attitude towards U.S. citizens or U.S. culture, including government institutions or founding principles. The memo says the vetting process should extend to students in the United States as of 7th of October 2023, whose visas are up for renewal. In recent weeks, the U.S. government has revoked the visas of a number of students it claims have expressed support for the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. Continue with The Guardian's coverage of this story. The new procedures are certain to prompt concerns that social media posts supportive of the Palestinians that contain critical commentary on U.S. foreign policy or that indicate attendance at a campus protest could trigger a comprehensive visa review. The cable does not require visa denials to be predicated on explicit support for any specific group and goes beyond traditional security screening, allowing officers to investigate an applicant's relationship with organizations including current membership, financial contributions, or other forms of support. The State Department did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The new order lands amid an already intensifying crackdown on pro-Palestinian activists nationwide. Secretary of State Marco Rubio on Thursday 27th of March said he had revoked more than 300 visas targeting students connected to campus protests. The latest example is the capture of Rumeysa Öztürk, a Turkish Fulbright scholar at Tufts University, who was detained by plainclothes agents wearing masks in broad daylight. The updated screening process references two of Donald Trump's early-term executive orders focused on foreign terrorists and combating anti-Semitism. The memo reads, "Every visa decision is a national security decision." National Public Radio, NPR, has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Trump administration on Friday, 28th of March, asked the U.S. Supreme Court to intervene to allow the government to continue to deport immigrants using the obscure Alien Enemies Act. The request came just one day after a federal appeals court upheld a Washington, D.C. federal judge's temporary block on immigrant expulsions by a wartime act that allows the administration to bypass normal due process, for example, by allowing people a court hearing before shipping them out of the United States. Friday's emergency request claims the federal court's order temporarily blocking the removal of Venezuelans forces the United States to harbor individuals whom national security officials have identified as members of a so-called foreign terrorist organization bent upon grievously harming Americans. Donald Trump's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act has spurred a legal battle between the executive and judicial branches of the U.S. federal government. Lee Gelernt, in a statement on Friday afternoon, said, "We will urge the Supreme Court to preserve the status quo to give the courts time to hear this case so that more individuals are not sent off to a notorious foreign prison without any process, based on an unprecedented and unlawful use of a wartime authority." Lee Gelernt is the deputy director of the American Civil Liberty Union's Immigrants' Rights Project and lead counsel in the case. As the executive branch of the government continues to battle the constitutionally co-equal judicial branch for primacy, the U.S. Justice Department said in its filing on Friday, 28th of March, that the case presents the question of who decides how to conduct sensitive national security-related operations, the President of the United States or the judiciary. The Justice Department wrote, "The Constitution supplies a clear answer to this question, the President. The Republic cannot afford a different choice." On 15th of March, Donald Trump invoked the Alien Enemies Act, a wartime statute allowing the U.S. government to expel foreign nationals considered to be enemies of the United States. When invoking the act, Trump, without proof, claimed that the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua had infiltrated the United States at the behest of the Venezuelan government. A U.S. intelligence document accessed by the New York Times contradicts Donald Trump's claim about the Venezuelan government's ties to the gang. That day, attorneys filed an emergency motion to block the use of the Alien Enemies Act to expel migrants to El Salvador. Then planes took off from the United States, transporting the nearly 300 immigrants accused of being gang members. As the planes were in midair, a federal judge in Washington blocked the use of the Alien Enemies Act to expel the immigrants.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a number of distinguished reciters of the Holy Quran in a gathering titled Communion with the Holy Quran. This meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on the first day of the blessed month of Ramadan, March 2nd, 2025. The recitation of these verses leads to purification. What does purification mean? It means a healing of the soul and heart. That is the meaning of purification. The human heart, spirit, and soul are healed of those ailments I mentioned earlier. This is what purification means. The Quran does this. The recitation of the Quran purifies. A few people sit and recite in a style that is called tartil. But that's not tartil, what the Quran states. And recite the Quran with tartil in a measured tone. Surah 73, verse 4. Tartil means reading the Quran with comprehension, contemplation, and pauses. We have sent the Quran in discrete parts so that you may recite it for the people. A little at a time. Surah 17, verse 106. This is tartil. Tartil is a spiritual matter. Know what you are doing, what you are reciting, what you are delivering to the person in front of you, and in what form you are presenting it. This is also important, and I may touch upon this as well. That's what tartil is. Subhanallah. According to the conventional methods that are now well known among reciters and those who have written about Quranic recitation, the Quran is recited in one of three ways: tahqiq, tadweer, and tazheer. Tadweer is something in the middle, and it's what we now refer to as tartil. Its scientific and technical name is tadwir. Above is tahqiq, which is the type of recitation you perform. Below that is hadr or tahdir, which means reading the Quran quickly and rapidly. If the Quran is recited using tartil in the sense that I mentioned, not in the commonly understood sense, it will have an impact. As a note on the side, let me say that reciting the Quran in the tadweer style, which we call tartil, is a very important, interesting task. The fact that it has now become widespread throughout the entire country, in Mashhad, Qom, Jamkaran, Khuzestan, Ahwaz, Tabas, everywhere they recite the Quran and it is broadcast on television, this is something very valuable. This is a very good practice.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Controversial remarks by the Israeli envoy have sparked outrage among the Palestinian solidarity community in Austria. Addressing members of the Jewish community on March 20, Ambassador David Roet is heard saying there should be a death sentence for 16-year-old teenagers in Gaza, and if Europe invests in rebuilding Gaza, Israel will have to destroy it the next time. Palestine solidarity activists launched a petition to the Austrian government calling for the expulsion of the diplomat.
In the video, he called for the death penalty for minors in Gaza and emphasized that Israel will continue to destroy Gaza. So he not only defended Israel's genocidal strategy, but even endorsed it. This is unacceptable for an international representative, and therefore he must be recalled.
The remarks have been heavily condemned by Jewish anti-Zionist activists in Austria who have recently launched the Vienna Jewish Anti-Zionist Declaration to strengthen Jewish pro-Palestinian voices in Europe. They criticized the close relationship between the Austrian Prime Minister Christian Stocker and the Israeli ambassador.
There is obviously a very close contact between Stocker and the Israeli embassy in a time where there is a genocide in Gaza, which is unacceptable for us, from the and we as a Jewish anti-Zionist initiatives, we condemn this strongly, and we will continue to pressure our government to stop all ties with Israel.
Some lawyers and solicitors prepared legal steps in response to the comments made by Roet and those in attendance.
From a legal perspective, it's difficult to do anything because the ambassador is immune. The immunity would have to be lifted to prosecute him, and the government won't do that. The real scandal, however, is that the remarks aren't even being investigated by police.
While there is strong condemnation in the international media, Austrian journalists have been silent about the video.
Activists are outraged over the continued alliance between the genocidal regime in Israel and the Austrian government. In a balanced act of disrespect to the Palestinian community, no Palestinian representatives were invited to the annual iftar hosted in the city hall by the mayor of Vienna last Thursday. While no Palestinian representatives were invited, Israeli representatives attended the event and were seated in the first row. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
Over 3 weeks of daily U.S. airstrikes across Yemen have failed to achieve their declared goals of ending the Yemeni blockade against Israeli shipments in the Red Sea. When the Trump